Our next speaker is Bernard Sheehan, recently retired professor of history at Indiana University. Indiana University Press is publisher of one of my favorite books, Crow Killer, the story of liver-eating Johnson, on whom the movie Jeremiah Johnson was made based. He's going to speak today on the Indian as noble victim.
My task is to speak about Indians in 15 minutes. I can do only a small portion of what all of us would like to know, I assume. The title is The Indian as Noble Victim. White men have been thinking about Indians since Columbus sailed into the Caribbean in the 15th century. Seldom in that long period, however, have they paid much attention to the real Indian. They have been interested largely in themselves, and as a consequence, most conceptions of the native people have been extensions of the European and the American imaginations. Columbus saw the Indians as savages, an idea derived from ancient thinking that has persisted into the current century. From that early perception, later generations have drawn a host of equally wrong-headed notions of what constituted the native world. The Indian, for example, has been seen as an agent of untethered violence, a hapless victim, a member of a vanishing race, a moral exemplar, a repository of ecological wisdom, a source of constitutional law, and a harbinger of a new age. Needless to say, none of these descriptions quite fits the real Indian. Most of them are far wide of the mark. Thus, no vision of the Indian has endured longer and been the source of as much scholarly and popular mischief as the savage in both the noble and the ignoble form. After the appearance of the New World on the European horizon, Montaigne in the late 16th century offered the most apt definition of the noble side of that creature. He painted a picture of pristine innocence set against the common features of European civilization. In fact, the picture was blank. He described a native world devoid of letters, numbers, politics, property, commerce, farming, and political order, in which humanity contrived to be at the same time both idle and prosperous. In the middle of the next century, Hobbes reversed the image, describing its ignoble form. Using most of Montaigne's categories, he added the absence of society, which Montaigne had only implied. Hobbes portrayed a scene of unrelieved human misery and viciousness, presided over by the grinding fear of violent death. Neither conception added anything to anthropological clarity. Human beings are not blank slates, and societies and the societies they construct are not empty vessels doomed never to be filled. American Indians inhabited a world strikingly different from the life transplanted in the New World from Europe, but it was not a world without parts. It was a genuine way of life and not simply an antic appendage of the European experience. Although the idea of the savage in both its forms has pervaded European and American thinking about the Indian, a rough division in usage can be made between the two sides. The noble savage has usually been the possession of the intellectuals, often enough those who have experienced little contact with the native people. The obvious exceptions support the generalization. The ignoble savage idea proved more congenial to those people who lived on the border between the two societies and hence experienced closer contact. Rivalry for land and war no doubt fueled this attitude. Thomas Jefferson's career, I think, makes the point. Although he never lived in near Indian country or even visited it, when most of the warriors joined the British in the Revolutionary War, he made his views of Indian savagery clear in the Declaration of Independence. and later he recommended their extermination. But after the revolution, in the quiet of his study, he often fell into the ways of the intellectual and compared his own society unfavorably to the life lived by the noble Indians. At the close of the 19th century, when the Indian wars had died down and the warrior was no longer a danger, the ignoble savage gradually went out of style. But the noble savage, with his claim to innocence and virtue, persisted and has fed the 20th century appetite for victims. One could hardly dispute the native people's claim to victimhood. After the arrival of the European settlers, the native population declined precipitously. Their land base dwindled, and eventually their cultural integrity collapsed. In the last quarter of the 19th century, the remaining independent tribes were confined to reservations and became wards of the government. No doubt, part of this process could be laid at the feet of the Europeans. They intended to displace the Indians on the greater part of their lands, and from the earliest years, they sought the transformation of the native culture. It was not until the 1930s that the federal government abandoned assimilation as the basis of its Indian policy and decided to preserve the Indians in their native ways. But by any measure, the most serious factor in native decline, the catastrophic drop in population from about 7 million, which is the high estimate, north of Mexico at the time of discovery, to approximately 500,000 in 1900, could not be attributed to purposive actions of white men. Instead, it was the unwitting transfer to America of maladies, mainly smallpox and various respiratory diseases, that Indians had never before experienced that dealt the most serious blow to the native population. Warfare, though frequent enough between the two societies, trailed at a distant second. Many whites were no doubt pleased at the drop in native numbers, and some even suggested that the process be encouraged, but the spread of disease could not generally be attributed to deliberate actions. Although victims of a sort, and for long periods of time apparently on the road to extinction, the Indians never quite vanished. They fought with Europeans and among themselves at regular intervals, and except in certain limited circumstances, the death toll was never high. In fact, it was usually higher among the whites. Of course, white numbers could better afford the loss. Over the long term, alcohol, which Indians in North America never possessed, spread devastation. It became indispensable to the Indian trade, and all measures by both the British and the American governments to curb its sale proved futile. From the beginning, the Indians found European products attractive, but they tended to adopt them to their own uses. In time, however, this transfer of cultural artifacts worked subtle changes in native life. The Indians became more and more dependent on trade with the whites to supply the goods they required to make their way in this new environment. To take one example, the Indians soon discovered the efficiency of muskets in hunting and war, but they had no tradition of metallurgy and thus depended on white gunsmiths for repair of these fragile instruments. Nor could they make powder themselves, which gave the Europeans a critical measure of control over Indian activity. Neither the British Empire nor the American government sought the extermination of the native people. On the contrary, from the beginning, assimilation had been the intention. Though not without its successes, assimilation never seemed to fully triumph over Indian resistance and the deleterious consequences of European presence in America. Decline in population, a shrinking land base, chronic alcoholism, and a growing dependence all undercut much of the hope for the incorporation of the Indians into the white man's world. By the first half of the 19th century, collapse and malaise seemed far more characteristic of the tribes east of the Mississippi than assimilation. Within the next half century, the process largely repeated itself west of the river, though intermarriage, government schools, missionary efforts, and migration into the cities once again afforded a measure of success. In the 20th century, policy moved from assimilation to preservation, turning great numbers of Indians into welfare clients. It is important to observe that societies don't disintegrate simply because they are assaulted by powerful external forces. They collapse to some extent because of internal weaknesses. Indians faced an aggressive European culture with Stone Age technology, weak political organization, extraordinary susceptibility to disease, low resistance to alcoholism, and finally, an animism that left them a limited capacity to accommodate adversity. They depended on shamans to mediate between the spirit world and the immediate human situation. With the coming of Europeans, shamans found it increasingly difficult to stave off the risk of pollution. For many Indians, the very order of reality had lost its stable core. In the late 20th century, this doleful story caused much anguish among intellectuals and reformers who, unhappy with their own world, were prompted to stress the responsibility of Europeans and to exaggerate the virtue of the native people who had endured so much suffering, thus raising the level of the white man's guilt. As Johann Huizinga described the process, a culture wishing to be free of itself experiences the perpetual longing for the uncivilized. As a consequence, many historians, Wilkham Washburn and James Axtell come to mind, sought evidence of noble savagery in the native way of life. They didn't find quite the social void that Montaigne had led them to expect, but they did discover a number of traits that matched liberal moral and social ideals. Indians, they contended, were free, equal, democratic, pacifist, feminist, sexually uninhibited, ecologically blessed, and curiously, happily communal, and in touch with the primal energies that rule the universe. As anthropology, the project was largely worthless. Only the last point had much merit. The native people were indeed communal and believed themselves to be in league with the spirit forces that ruled the world. Most Indians were organized socially into clans and small villages united by kinship. But that is about all that can be said for these recent interpretations. Take the other supposed native traits in turn. Indians might have been free before the European encounter in the sense that they were generally not dominated by a foreign power. But it must be noted that in the 17th century, the Iroquois in the northeast held sway over the remnants of a dozen or so conquered tribal groups, as did Powhatan in Virginia and the Natchez on the lower Mississippi. Otherwise, Indians were not free in the way that European settlers in America were to try to become in the late 18th century. They remained bound by communal and kinship obligations, very different from the contractual arrangements that increasingly characterized the lives of their white neighbors. Equality, of course, involved a similar set of definitions. It implied individualism, the separation of the person from organic and historical ties, a personal autonomy quite foreign to Indian conceptions. Although native societies were not steeply hierarchical, they were, as were European before the late 18th century, they were organized vertically. The authority often rested loosely in family groups and could be hereditary. Although land was communal, personal property was not. Even the potlatch, which ended in the distribution of property, required a preliminary accumulation and, of course, established the prestige of the person responsible. Thus, talk of freedom and equality, although among the Indians, as though they were qualities of a life unencumbered by social boundaries, makes no anthropological sense. In the sense that democracy required individualism, the Indian tribes were hardly democratic. The issue here usually centers on the Iroquois League. This arrangement had been created in the late 15th century by the five Iroquois tribes that lived in what was to become New York in order to end the strife that had been constant in the region. In the future, instead of fighting among themselves, the Iroquois would be free to subjugate their neighbors. It was an alliance among independent groups and exercised no governing authority, nor was it democratic. The Grand Council of the League contained unequal representation from each of the tribes. Some of the members were hereditary and some appointed. Could such an institution have served as the archetype of the Constitution? A number of historians think so. In the late 80s, Congress thanked the Iroquois for their contribution to the nation's founding. And in 1996, the William & Mary Quarterly devoted 50 pages on the subject. Not only did the argument in favor of the thesis prove to be extraordinarily thin, but the founders knew little about the structure of the League. The League itself bore no resemblance to the Constitution. If the founders had chosen to duplicate it, the American Republic would certainly have been a very different kind of political order. The significance of this curious episode lies in the continued effort of many intellectuals to find what obtained among the Indians superior to their own ways. There can be little doubt that Indian warfare, mainly because of the improvement in technology, became more destructive after the European arrival. But at the same time, it is clear that native life before that date was fraught with violence. Young men gained their manhood by proving themselves in hunting and war. Compensation might sometimes be made in every injury required redress. Compensation might sometimes be made in goods, but more often it involved murder and mayhem. As a result, native life was far from peaceful. In the wars of empire that engulfed the eastern half of the continent in the 18th century, neither the French nor the British had trouble finding Indian allies. In fact, the long history of conflict in North America seldom involved simply Indians against whites. As for feminism, native culture did conform to one branch of the modern feminist movement. Women occupied a separate sphere. The village and domestic life belonged to them. But native societies were not matriarchal. East of the Mississippi, however, they were generally matrilineal, which gave women, invariably older women, considerable influence in clan affairs. Sometimes this role spilled over into the political arena, as, for example, in selecting the membership of the Grand Council of the Iroquois League. Clan mothers exercised a veto on membership, but they did not serve on the council, and they did not wield formal political power, even in the villages. If Indians were sexually unrestrained, they would certainly be an exception among primitive people. Lack of inhibition seems more characteristic of civilization or decadence than of native cultures. It is true that early explorers found an ample supply of what they called trade women, but this practice was probably more indicative of the requirements of hospitality and the status of women than any tendency toward excessive sexual freedom. In truth, Indians lived by strict rules concerning sex. They were monogamous and punished adultery by women severely, sometimes with mutilation. The menses held sacred meaning, and women at that time of month posed a serious threat to the future success of hunters and warriors. Although warriors from the eastern tribes regularly took female captives in their raids on both whites and Indians, they did not engage in rape, not because they had any particular respect for women, but because of the taboo that attached to sexual activity during periods of conflict. Clearly, Indians did not live by the sexual rules that bound Europeans, but neither did they enjoy the mythic promiscuity attributed to the noble savage. Do the Indians deserve their reputation for ecological wisdom? Certainly, they made a less significant mark on their environment than the Europeans who came after them. For one thing, their numbers were far fewer. At the most, 7 million Stone Age people living in the vast stretches of the continent north of Mexico were not likely to greatly change the character of the land. Yet it remains true that any human population, no matter its size, will leave traces of itself. The Indians, for example, made generous use of fire, sometimes with salutary consequences, but frequently in order to slaughter great numbers of animals or to defeat the enemy. And east of the Mississippi, in the Southwest, and in California, they farmed the land. Early settlers in New England describe extensive acreage under cultivation. Native villages could hold numbers above 1,000 with the attendant consequences for the surrounding landscape. The continent was far from an untouched Eden when the Europeans made their landings. The argument for the ecological Indian hinges in great measure on the native belief in the sacral nature of both animate and inanimate nature. This belief did require native people to hunt and to farm with care for the ceremonial niceties of their animism, but it did not keep them from cultivating large fields and moving on to new lands when they had worn out the old. Nor did it keep some tribes from using a buffalo jump in hunting, or fire for mass kills, or stream poisoning to increase the take in fish. The ceremonial Indian was not necessarily the provident Indian. In truth, late 20th century interpretations that treat the Indian as an ideal are a long way from Montaigne and Hobbes. The noble savage is only a pale reflection of the existential void so evident in the early years of discovery and settlement. The current generation has made that venerable figure a convenient pawn against which to measure their own world, and in the process, they do a great deal of violence to the real Indian. He is reduced to a parody of their own unfulfilled longings, a perverse kind of ideological imperialism that detaches the native people from their own culture and absorbs them into the white man's struggle to be free of his own discontent. Thank you.